Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld, and this program is about the evolution of our consciousness, how we as a civilization are becoming a new species, and we need to be because the planet and our future depends upon it. And that is why I am talking to my very good friend tonight, Mitchell J. Rabin. He does a program called The Better World. It's a cable show and a radio show, and he's been a big inspiration for me. And we cover some of the same territory, but you know, we also cover different areas. And I think, Mitchell, you are more environmentally conscious. Not that I'm not, but your energies are about the inner and outer ecologies, and I think we we talked about talking about that. So let's talk about that, okay?
sure, Alan. First of all, it's a pleasure to be on with you, Alan. We've been doing so many things for so many decades, actually, and we're Dharma brothers. That's the way I think about it, you know.
Dharma brothers is a good way. Yeah, we cover, you know, overlapping territory. I think, you know, we're part of this, and of course we're part of many organizations together, part of this phase of consciousness, and we need people like us to start to bring the message out to whoever will listen, really, right?
I agree with you. We share the really, fundamentally, we share very much the same vision, and we overlap hugely, and at the same time, we want to cover areas of our own unique passion, because we have a big Earth and a big galaxy and a big universe to cover. So if we were doing exactly the same things, you know, the source would get a little concerned.
That's right. It's like there's a lot of liver cells, but each one of those cells are doing a slightly different job.
Exactly.
Make the whole organism function. So, I'm interested, you know, of course, in your studies with the higher brain living, but also how does that hook into the overall ecology and evolution of the Earth, a better world? How do you link the two, the outer ecology and the inner ecology? I'm very interested.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, I really did sort of divide the universe into these kind of fundamental rubrics, inner and outer ecology, because everything is part of an ecosystem, including our inner biology. So if I see the entire universe as some large cosmic ecosystem, which I personally believe it is, and I think it's a good way to kind of define it, why not think of the inner terrain this way as well? And so from that point of view...
Very Taoist, isn't it?
It is. And it's also very alchemical in as far as so within, as within, so without, and as above, so below.
Yes.
You know?
Yes,
and really looking at the fractal relationship of all things. And I know you and I share that perspective very, very deeply. And if we do embrace that quantum physical / metaphysical perspective, that the outer world is really an outpicturing of our inner life and our inner psyche to some pretty significant extent, that the universe out there isn't some kind of mechanical watch, Newtonian style, but rather part of an entire quantum field, we can appreciate the idea that what we think is having a direct impact on our outer body, so-called, and on our outer universe. And
well, you know, you make a very important point that I had never thought of before, but we classify the universe, according to science, as very non-living. It's like suddenly life arises.
Yeah.
But if we see the outer world as a reflection of the inner world, then the universe has to be just as alive outside as it is inside. So thank you for that insight.
Yeah,
yes.
You're so welcome. Yeah, I mean, the way we were taught in early, you know, junior high school science, as you remember, Alan, is that the outside world is basically sort of like a series of big rocks, you know, planets are rocks, asteroids are rocks, the Earth is a rock, and it's just nothing short of a completely inexplicable miracle that this thing called life and biology showed up. You know, no scientist can actually wrap his or her head around that phenomenon, yet that's why we're here. We can even discuss it.
They call that the hard question of science. You know, there are three hard questions. How did the universe suddenly appear from nothing?
Yeah, exactly.
How did life suddenly appear? And how did conscious aware life suddenly appear? Those are the three questions I don't think they'll ever answer if they're looking at it from a purely materialistic basis.
That's right, exactly. And that's very well articulated. And it's really true that those three are truly fundamental to everything else we can really query about our lives and the nature of reality. So with this as a premise, that we have a conscious mind and we can do inner and outer reflection, we begin to seek to design our brain. Now, this is a really fun part, which does bring in the higher brain living piece. It also brings in a lot of this delightful work that's taking place these days among neuroscientists, Rick Hansen, Stan Tatkin, Joe Dispenza, Mario Martinez are just some of the people that I've been dealing with on A Better World Radio and TV, and, you know, have some relationship with Dr. Richard Davidson as well, who is asked by the Dalai Lama to interview his bevy of advanced Buddhist monks to examine their brain. Well, it's a very interesting thing. It's sort of like I think of also the work of Richard Bandler, who I studied NLP with many moons ago, who wrote a book called Using Your Brain for a Change. And, you know, most people don't really quite do that. They let their brains use them. So they're always living, in a sense, in a victim mode, not realizing that their brain was an instrument, or as Woody Allen would say, it's my second favorite organ, you know, as a means of actually designing their lives. Joe Dispenza happens to be one particular fellow who is very articulate on the subject of using the brain. He doesn't quite put it this way, but I think he means it or implies it, as almost a roadmap. Richard Bandler certainly did that. So if you look at the brain and all the neural network, the web of it, it looks very much like any kind of ganglia that we see in nature, like a fungal ganglia, or protozoa in the sea. It's really interesting. We see the same, like, really sacred geometrical pattern showing up over and over again in different corners of the universe. And I think that we've been given charge of this one so that it's an electrical, chemical reality that also has a magnetic pull. So on one hand, we're sending out electrical signals very much the way a receiver does and an antenna. And it's got a magnetic pulse to it as well that largely arises from our emotions and our passions. And, you know, the great old teacher of dance and mystic, George Ivanovich Gurdjieff, used to talk about the heart as a magnetic center, that our lives are in some way designed and attracts what is inside our magnetic center. And our lives will take on a certain tenor, a certain frequency based on that magnetic center. So it gets really interesting. On the one hand, the brain is essentially electrical and the heart is electro and magnetic. So what you've got is this sending a signal, a sort of a yang act, and then you've got the magnetic pull, which is a yin act, if you will. So you've got a sending and a receiving mechanism built into our nervous system. By the way, I really think of the heart as part of our nervous system.
Absolutely.
It's really very so electrical.
No, I like what you're saying about the brain. So what about the brain? It sends signals, and of course we're receivers of signals. That's how we pick up empathy and psychic signals and remote viewing and telepathy and all those things that are that I know for sure are true because I've experienced them.
Exactly.
So, yeah, so what are you saying about the brain? And then, of course, the new use of the brain.
Yes, exactly. So what I'm saying is the higher function of the brain beyond the reptilian, fight, fright, freeze frame, as they say.
The four Fs, in other words, you know.
Yeah, right.
Fight, flight, food, and having sex. Yes.
Right. And while we wouldn't want to be without that brain, God knows. And then, of course, nature gave us the mammalian brain, which was a chance to sort of warm up the blood, and then we became from cold-blooded to warm-blooded, essentially as a life form. And we started to feel each other. We could pulse with each other. We could then sympathize and empathize with each other. Eventually, when consciousness increases, we can stand in each other's shoes and understand what it's like to feel, what it's like to be one another.
Well, we can do that now. Isn't that where we are now?
Yeah, now we do, because we've also developed, of course, the prefrontal cortex. And we've got the frontal lobe. So, wow, the whole game changes. So our brain is a series of layers. And the point I'm making with consciousness, Alan, is that we can now set up our lives. We can design them. We can shape them like a sculptor. A sculptor forms a sculpture with clay. But we've got electrochemistry in our brain to do that with, and a magnetic center in our heart to do that with. So we can use language as the shaping tool for what we want our lives to look like.
Oh, so language is very much a part of our creating a future, because what does language do exactly?
There you go. This is my view, you know. I'm not a scientist in some kind of kind of technical way, but I am. We're all scientific in that we, and artists in that we use those different aspects of our brain for imagining a world. I mean, I feel that really imagination is God's greatest gift to us, because we can put ourselves into each other's shoes. We can put ourselves into a rocket ship and go to, you know, outer space. We can go into our deeper spaces, whatever, with the gift of our imagination. So from this point of view, from a sculptor's point of view, let's say, we can use language and image as a way of beginning to carve out the neural pathways of a life we see for ourselves, of a life we want for our species, a life we want next week, or even later today.
Let me see if I integrate that. I mean, a lot of it is what Joe Dispenza said, evolve your brain, and he's really brilliant. But you're saying, by using language and images, we can create a neural pathway that will give us the future we want to inhabit. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, I am. That's exactly
how do we create, and I think Joe gets into this in Creating Your Day, how do we create a future that we don't have a language for, that we don't even have an image for? Is it possible? Because that is the real, I know that's getting off your thesis.
But how
do we create something we don't have a language for and we don't even have a sense of? But that's the essence of evolution, is to make known the unknown.
Yes, it's a very good point. First of all, I just want to say, based on the language we do know and the imagery we can conceive and being in a physical body today, I use this material in my work with clients as a therapist, as a coach, as a counselor, and stress management consultant. You know, I do these things. I work with people in ways to help them gain some level of objective consciousness toward their bodies and toward their emotions, so they can feel more the captain of their own ship. So that's a very kind of practical application.
No, I think it's important. I like what you're doing with people, and I think if people can language a feeling, it puts them in touch with it, and they have power over that, instead of the situations having power over them.
Exactly. Exactly. So important. Now to go into the space that you propose, because I know you love the space, and I think it's really
it's the key to evolution. We are evolving into what we don't know, because if we already know it, it's already done. But evolution is the unknown possibility that we have yet to dream.
Exactly. It's that fertile space that we don't know what happens in that, you know, in the formation of the zygote, to get, you know, at least an analog. But I understand what you're going with this, and I really appreciate it. And I would say that, in fact, this domain has been articulated through practices such as Zen, and the whole notion of shunyata, of emptiness, is where we flip into that space of the quantum field, which it's a soup. We don't know its ingredients. We don't have a language for it. And language can bring us to that tipping point, if you will. It can bring us to the edge of the cliff when we then jump off into the unknown that is non-languaged. Language brings us the notion of the ineffable that, of course, Lao Tzu is always pointing to. If you think about it, it's rife in our ancient wisdom literature, in our poetry, of coming to this place where language no longer has a place and a peg, if you will, and we leap into this unknown.
What does the unknown look like? How do we know it's the unknown?
Well, if we don't know it, I think we're safe to say that it's unknown. There's a wisdom in impermanence. There's a wisdom in uncertainty, because we know that that's the way things are, that everything is absolutely in a constant state of change. And if we can quiet down our verbal capacity and go into that no mind, that space, we're allowing the Tao, you know, which is something you and I have both gotten a lot into over the years, to just flow its own natural intelligence. Call it whatever we may. We have stepped out of the stream of our mental chatter, and we go into wherever we go.
But I think also, sorry to interrupt, but I think that's where going with the higher brain functioning, as you open the prefrontal cortex and create new neural nets that haven't existed within the human field, because the field also is influencing our neural nets. As we create new here, as we make known the unknown, we start to evolve the collective as well.
Exactly, because we're just a micro of the macro, and you and I are both fans of the wonderful great penseur, Terence McKenna, and you helped me interview
Terence.
Him many years ago, way back, and one of the things that Terence has taught both you and me and so many others is the importance of novelty, and novelty brings us to that fresh moment of the unknown. And of course, they've done experiments with Zen monks, for instance, who are so present, they find, that each time they ring the bell of the time, or for supper, or what have you, they have ways of measuring the experience of that bell as fresh and novel every single time it rings. Mm. That's what, you know, Zen mind, of course, calls of Zen mind, beginner's mind. It's, there are no preconceptions. There's not a verbal understanding of what the experience is prior. There's just,
unless of course
being
they forgot
present.
Their lost their memory. And I'm sort of making a joke, but I'm also saying, what's the difference between the Zen moment and those that
Alzheimer's?
Are in a way, or unaware, I mean, if everything is fresh, where does experience come in? Where does
Could say the same thing then about the wonderful work of Eckhart Tolle too, because you know, at that moment when you are engaging Eckhart's teaching, you are present with your body in movement, same as with the work of Gurdjieff, and you're in motion, but you're not commenting on, you're not languaging your experience, you're just being non-verbally present with it. And of course, words and language show up, but the point of it is not that. The point is the presence. But coming back to the prefrontal cortex,
and language and image. Let's come back to
and
that.
And language and image, and what I'm doing with Higher Brain Living, which is
a rather brilliant
method that really very much arises out of the work of Dr. Donnie Epstein originally. I mean, certainly I see it that way. It's pretty clear.
Of course it does.
Of the right of these, you know, gentle points touched along the spine, the ankles, the knees, you know, several different places in the body. And but what Dr. Michael Cotton did is find some, I don't know how to put it, some new vector that somehow we are getting. I'm seeing it in my clients. It's really rather remarkable.
What are you seeing in your clients, your higher brain?
I'm seeing, Alan, these sorts of reactions to these gentle touches in a certain sequence that is seems to be releasing energy that's been stored up for a long time, a la Wilhelm Reich's notion of repression of emotions in the muscles. That's what it looks like. Things are getting released from the organs, from the jaw, from the pelvis, and they are old emotions, oftentimes fear-related or abandonment-related or rejection-related, and people start to feel rather blissful. And it's a beautiful thing to bear witness to. And there's something, you know, here's an example of not knowing how something works, yet observing that it's working over and over again. So,
give me a really clear example in detail, like how it is. Can you do that from people you've noticed? Like, what do you do? What's the reaction? What's going on?
Okay. For instance, one client is lies on the table. Touch her in the prescribed sequence, as I learned in my training of advanced, facilitation from Michael Cotton's classes. And when I do that, her body begins to undulate in certain ways that it wasn't doing before I touched her. And I don't think it's because I personally have such a magical touch. I think that may be some of it, but I think that the mainstay of it is the sequence of touches and the type, the pressure of the touch, and the vectors of the movement of the hand and the mind that's generating the movement, i.e. my mind.
Right, and what happens to her when you do these gentle...
Her body begins to undulate in around the sacral pump, the occipital pump, her chest moves, her breathing changes, sometimes her feet kind of at the ankles, they straighten and then they contract and decontract. That's a lot.
That's amazing. So
it's
according
amazing.
To Michael Cotton says that by doing these gentle movements, you're activating the cerebral spinal fluid to open up the frontal lobes and create this organic, joyful experience that the body wants to have, but we haven't allowed ourselves to release the energy connected with it.
Exactly.
Right?
And it's a process of breathing called salutogenesis is the phrase he uses. Salute, of course, being related to the Latin for health, sanus, really. That breath is an indicator to us that the higher brain or the prefrontal cortex has been activated. And this is where we talk about human potential. That's what we're talking about, is the activation, not of the reptilian brain for more fight and flight, not even so much for the mammalian brain, but for the neocortex to open and flower, just like all of the ancient iconography of the Hindus and the Sanskrit times.
Like a thousand petal lotus
flowers.
The flower, The flowering of the flowering of the thousand petal lotus.
Exactly, like the seventh chakra opening, you know, exactly. We have in acupuncture as well, essentially the same point at the top of the head. And it's not only the head brain, but it's the heart brain, and ultimately it's got to also involve the gut brain. You know, we have these three fundamental brains. And there's a spillover, you know, in the microcosmic orbit Taoist practice, there's this idea of the chi spilling down from the front of the brain, of the head, of the prefrontal cortex, down into the heart, and then circling around back up the spine. So a really interesting type of integration occurs. So that's what higher brain living is sort of awakening. It looks like it's having an accelerated effect on the opening of the prefrontal cortex.
And this is what, according to Michael Cotton, the inventor, says is an evolutionary tool for humanity, right?
Yes. Yes. There is a physiology that accompanies the changing of the species. And that has to do, I think, a lot with the opening up of portals, both on the planet and outside in the galaxy, you know, the so-called galactic center, that so many people are reporting that the Earth is receiving so many different kinds of frequencies these days, many of which are love frequencies, and we have to be the right receptor sites for those frequencies.
Who's saying those things are happening to the Earth? I haven't read those news reports.
You didn't hear it on CBS the other night?
No, there's love frequencies coming to the Earth. Yeah, no, I haven't heard that one. I mean, I believe it's possible. Where have you heard that? Because I suspect
an email that was written by a scientist talking about the effect of the galactic center on Earth. And in fact, I sent it to another mutual friend of ours, Yasuhiko Genku Kimura, who also thought that it was very, very interesting.
Well, send it to me. I
will.
You know.
I'll have to do a little digging for it at this point.
But that's
an idea that also I have heard coming forth from different largely channeled sources, which are not my main places of information. But it is a sense of that there is a liveliness happening. And this is one of your main domains, is extraterrestrial living in intelligence.
It certainly is. Thank you for bringing that up. But yes,
of course. And it's that there is a liveliness and an intelligence that they're trying to ping us, if you will, as a hello, take care of the Earth. You're dying. You're about to flip the whole thing. You know. So I look at things. Michael often talks about the sixth epoch. You know, a la his studies of the work of Ken Wilber et al., Gebzer and others. And there's also on the flip side of that, Alan, the sixth extinction. And Bruce Lipton and another good friend of ours talks about, as do many others as well. And I think that we're sort of boundering both of these. And depending on our human actions, including our human language and thoughts and feelings, all of it together in convergence and confluence, we will either move in the direction of the sixth, you know, flowering epoch, or to the extinction. And I think
we're right there between the balance.
We are.
Of evolution or destruction. Aren't we?
We really are. And that's why I look at the inner to the outer, but I also see the outer effect on the inner. Let's not kid ourselves. It's very real in all of our lives. You know, we see, a lovely woman on the street, and that outer experience gives us an inner warmth, you know, as an example, you know, or the sun is out instead of the rain clouds, and we go, and we smile. You know, there's this connectedness, complete connectedness to everything. And from that point of view, there's no such thing as inside and outside anyway. So, you know, that's a totally relativistic notion. And things like mirror neurons, things like non-locality, these quantum physical principles really underscore this deep knowing that I feel that we all really have if we're open to sense it and experience it. So from that point of view, I really do put a lot of emphasis on our beautiful natural world, our Gaia, our Earth Mother, and really take her into sacred account with a lot of my personal and professional thoughts and actions. So it's sort of like if we don't have air to breathe and water to drink, this game is over. So I take that very seriously in the call of a lot of the environmental movement and the whole issue of global warming and climate change. So,
but let's go back to this part. Okay, so the brain, the human brain, is probably the most sophisticated mechanism, at least probably on planet Earth, right? I mean,
yes.
It's and we have yet to access its full capacity. It's like we have these software programs that we don't even know exist, and they're just waiting to be activated. So now, how is this new activation of the brain connect? I'm trying to figure out. I know there is a connection to the outer environment. Is it something like as we activate more of our human potential, we'll have greater compassion for the Earth? I mean, how do you bridge the brain evolution and, you know, the edge of destruction?
Oh, yes. Good question.
Yes.
Well, I would put it this way. As we develop in our prefrontal cortex, it also then, as I said, connects directly with the heart, which is the temple of some 40,000 neuroreceptor sites, and we have the Institute of Heart Math to thank for that kind of data. And so we've got this heart-brain type of integration that's going on, the heart being the seat of love and compassion in ancient literature all the way through all world poetry. We all know that there's a relationship between the heart and love. So if our brain is starting to expand and, you could say, spill over into the heart cortex. Interesting way of putting it. I've never quite framed it that way, but it is essentially that. It's a cortex and a nexus.
What is a cortex? I'm not sure what you mean.
Well, it's like a ganglion, if you will. That's
the brain. The
a
brain
pretty word,
these...
yeah. Except
it's
centered here, you know,
in the heart.
Right, our upper center. And if it's going to be expanding, what is it going to be expanding with? Not more blood, not more pumping. That's just the physical. On the etheric level, on the energetic level, on the emotional level, it's starting to pulse with more love and more compassion, which means that we see with and through our hearts. And that's a nonverbal experience, by the way, to go back to something you were kind of referencing earlier of a non-languaged state of the unknown, of what it's like to not be caught in the web of language, but to be free of it, but to have the experience of deep, profound kind of, shall I say, universal love or cosmic love that goes beyond language, yet can be, to some limited extent, articulated. So we're deeply in the experience of pulsing with life inside us through our heart and feeling connected to all things. So that's where the feeling intelligence overrides what we refer to as mental intelligence.
And the personality. I think, okay, so that's...
together here?
No, that's a good answer to the question I was looking for, I was sensing, but I think you did express it very well in the sense as we evolve, as we open up the greater mind, we in a sense also transcend the personality ego, and we realize, you know, through the seventh chakra, everyone would call it, that we are part of the universal intelligence, and that universal intelligence obviously is not separate from the universe or the planet or the guy next door, for that matter.
Exactly.
And so We are becoming more universal beings with this awakening of these higher brain functions.
That's right. Another way of looking at sixth epoch or sixth extinction is sixth extinction is Homo ridiculus, and the sixth epoch is Homo universalis.
Right, or Homo Illuminatus, people.
Or
that's
Illuminatus,
also
right.
But it just makes sense thing. For those that, and I'm not trying to make a value judgment, but those that don't use their creative higher brain functions that are reacting out of the lower brain, mammalian, or fear sense, they're usually more violent, more
animal-like. Greedy. Control-based, exactly. Well,
this is exactly
what we're facing in the world today, right?
Yeah, right.
I mean, this is what we're facing.
Right.
I really do look at the world from a point of view of brain development, even more than I would of spiral dynamics. I see it as these people are living with 90% of their reptilian function engaged and using only 10% of their prefrontal lobes, and these other people are using 90% of their prefrontal lobes and only 10% of their reptilian impulse reactive fear function. Wow. Which one do I think is going to be creating a better world?
Well, a better world. I hope that's what you're doing. So
I'm working on it.
But they've also done studies with mothers and the mental attitudes of mothers. I don't know where I heard this, but the mothers that lived in fear when the baby was in utero would develop more of the lower brain, and the women that were having more joyful, the babies in those senses would have a more frontal lobe development. So we're inheriting this. Of course, we can overcome that because basically we all have the same equipment. It's like, what are we doing with that? So those people coming from living in fear, coming from survival, are using those mechanisms of the brain. And if they could somehow, and it's a collective thing, it takes a village, like they say, to come from this group dynamics and feel less stress, and more at peace and more connected, that will also initiate and wake up these higher, or allow those higher functionings to come online, if we want to put it that way.
Exactly. And the way I like to discuss that, Alan, is in public, is the notion of creating consensus around a new reality. Oh, you'll like that. Creating consensus
What does it mean?
What does that mean? That means this. That means if we have more people who are coming out of the higher level functioning of their brain, which, by the way, includes their heart, as I've been pretty clear about.
Yes, very good.
So you're dealing with a more integrated being, or, Gurdjieff used to talk about becoming a harmonious man and woman, which means all three centers are unified and together. Then we're talking about building a new reality based on trust, on brotherhood and sisterhood, on love and compassion, on fun, artistic life and amusement. It's a whole different world. Instead of having to say, do I have to watch my back? Do I have to be concerned that this person is going to take something from me? I have to be concerned about being jealous and envious and possessive. I have to be controlling the situation because otherwise, if I don't do that, everything will fall apart. You know, and that whole, reptilian style, which the world is actually governed on now. But if you look at some of the new initiatives, Transition Town movement, a lot of the communities that are developing around green and renewable resources and people who want to share. Some people are developing their own new currencies and they're forming communities all over the place, local communities eating local food. They're changing the vibration. They're changing the entire zeitgeist of living from one that was fear-based to one that's trust and love-based. And if we create consensus around that, meaning, i.e., it's okay to be this way, folks. It's okay. This is where we're going. This is where we're heading as the caterpillar becomes the butterfly. This is what it looks like, folks, when we start to fly. Then it gives permission to an increasing number of people to feel the same way. Just like, and you know this, Alan, you and I have been around this corner so many times. When people say, like, in a class, if you've done this, and I'm sure you have in some way, the teacher says, I can see auras. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to ask you all to see auras with me, i.e., he's creating a context in which the consensus is that people can see auras. Oh, you may not see it right away this very second. Give yourself a few seconds. Give yourself a minute or two or three, and you will begin to see it. With that level of fundamental permission, magic begins to happen. Synchronicities mm-hmm. begin to show up. That's what I'm talking mm-hmm. about.
Synchronicity. What is behind synchronicity? I've had them, but what do you make of them?
You've had them many times, and we've had them together.
We're having them right now. No,
there we go. All right. Well, okay. To break it down, of course, the word sync comes from the ancient Greek, where we get the word simultaneous.
Oh, I thought it came from the thing that's in the kitchen that you pour water in.
Ho, ho, ho. No, that was a reptilian joke, by the way. No, I'm kidding you.
Okay. It means together, right?
I'm sorry?
It means together, right? Doesn't it mean
right. Yeah. Synchronize, right. And chronos, of course, means time. So it mm-hmm. means same, literally it means same time.
But what do you think is happening? I know what it means, but what do you think is happening behind the scenes for synchronicities to manifest?
Yeah, good question. I think what's happening is a couple of things. We're freeing up our habituated brain and mindset. So we're seeing from a higher point of view the magic between linear and nonlinear time. Mm-hmm. We're entering a slightly different dimension that is afforded to us through harmony between the two lobes, harmony in what we call heart coherence or brain coherence. We get a stepped-up version of reality where we can see more things at the same time, and we can see the sort of the inherent organic sensibility of how, in reality, I think language and energy moves in and around us.
Right. So there's.
So if I have a thought, if I have a thought that Alan, I need to speak with Alan, and Alan calls me, it means you and I just converged on outside of ordinary time in some other synchronous, you know, parallel universe, to be funny about
that's
it.
That's what I think. I think there is something going on all the time here that's not about the linear world or the material world.
Exactly.
And in synchronistic moments, there's this convergence of time-space realities that reveal these higher levels that are functioning all the time.
Exactly. And we're getting an insight into it. It's like the experience of doing, a shamanically sanctioned plant, the way Terence McKenna used to refer to psychedelics, psychoactive plants, sacred plants. You know, it elicits the electrochemistry in the brain to see from a somewhat different dimension, where time as we know it as some kind of linear phenomenon, which is purely a concept, is it ceases, and we're relieved from it, and we see life as a gestaltic, holistic occurrence.
Gestaltic, that's a new word. Thank you.
Yeah, sure.
No, but I agree, and I think there is activities of the brain as we sink into these harmonic frequencies, as we hook up to what Bruce Lipton calls the coherency, as humanity becomes coherent, these levels of synchronicity start to unfold even more, and then you get to see someone like Bashar, the channel, who says his whole society runs on synchronicity.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what that means, but So getting back to the main point and creating a better world and this inner and outer ecology, what do you suggest to people besides doing your therapies? But what do you suggest? How do we start to sync up?
Yeah, right. Well, you know, one of the best ways is sort of to be quiet and to empty and to learn how to listen, both internally and externally. I find that there's not a whole lot of listening, but listening is a very powerful experience, and I do a lot of it, actually, as a therapist and coach and doing my stress management activity. There's a lot of time for being
Who do you listen to, others or yourself?
First I'm talking about myself, of being very quiet and listening to others. And there's a very great power in listening to another person's story. So first you get the story, and you yourself are becoming inwardly coherent from simply the listening. You're uniting with the other person's field, and they can feel it. I mean, you know that when you feel close to somebody, what's that all about? Your field, the morphogenetic field, is uniting between.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Thank you for that.
Know? Yeah. And it's a very beautiful experience. And then you can do that with each other, and you can also do that with the earth, which is why, I teach this class, Alan, I think you know, a couple times a month downtown New York at TRS called Heaven on Earth. And we spend a fair amount of time doing Qigong, very simple Qigong, especially Marriage of Heaven and Earth. And it's just to bring forth and unite these two types of chi inside ourselves. And when you move through this physical motion slowly, you're shifting your consciousness and you're sharing it with others in some kind of beautiful, boundaryless, nonverbal way. And it creates a sense of center and a sense of peace among the people. And it's precious. So one then has a greater kind of sacred respect for one's own body and one's and others and the environment itself, the actual Gaia landscape. And then you emerge from that not wanting to harm anyone, wanting to respect all sentient life and to take care of her and it.
It's interesting. They did a study and found that people who meditate more have a higher moral value. They tend to be, less cutthroat and more fair.
More integrity.
And I guess that's because they somehow tap into more of this collective. I mean, I don't quite understand why meditating would make you more moral, because I'm looking at it from the old point of view, but... Which is that what you do inside doesn't really affect the outside, or it doesn't affect your behavior. But that's the old conditioning.
Yeah.
And what you're saying and what I'm understanding here is that as we develop the internal mechanisms, we start to blend our field with a greater reality. I mean, I've suspected that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. One becomes soft. One becomes more... flowy. How is that for a word? You know,
that's a sound very new age. Flowy,
it does, doesn't it? I'm flowy. I'm feeling flowy. But you feel more grounded and connected and flowy all at the same time. You can borrow that word if you want. You know.
Well, I don't think I will. But thank you for lending it to me.
Let me put it this way: in one simple phrase, I as thou, and if you bridge that and you see the pain and suffering of others or the joy and glee of others, and you're feeling it and feeling it in your heart, you're connected, man, and you're not going to want to harm anybody, and you're going to work at what is, you know, our friend Lynn McTaggart in her book The Bond.
I was just going to mention Lynn McTaggart
because I think
the field effect is very, very important.
And the bonding that neuroscience beautifully articulates that we as a species survive not because we're killing each other and fight and flight and all of that. No, it's because we're cooperating with each other. We're loving each other. We're forming deep social bonds. Oxytocin is getting released into our bloodstream, and we're feeling closer and closer as time goes on. That's the way to create a new reality.
Absolutely. But I think there's also, we have to understand, Lynn, it's not her first book, but her first popular book, The Field, and understand that we are generators of a field, and we're affecting the field, and we're harmonizing the field. We exist in the field of humanity, but we also exist within smaller subfields. And if the more we create the harmony within ourselves, the more that emanates out from the field and has
very
a
much.
More
yeah.
universal effect. So
very
I think
much.
That's also
very
the
much.
Part of affecting
yeah.
the higher brain, affecting
exactly.
the ecology, uplifting the planet, and saving humanity. In
you
sense.
Know, as Maimonides said, to save one life is to save a universe, you know? And that's a really interesting, that's the fractal relationship articulated in ancient Jewish lore and wisdom, you know? So it's that same idea. It's that fractal, you know, I am you, you and me, you are me, and what I do inside myself. And this shows up everywhere. You know, even in the old AA model, you know, with an enabler and a drinker, you know, as the enabler sees what his or her role is in contributing based on their own emotional habits, I'll call them. Once they see that from a higher point of view and they change that, they are automatically, commensurately changing the behavior of the drinker. And they haven't
right.
said a word.
Right, and we could see that in our own lives when we change behaviors or, you know, there's lots
that's
of
exactly
things that
right.
we can do, because going back to what you said in the beginning of the show, we are senders and receivers of these frequencies.
Exactly.
So as we kind of wrap it all up, what
yeah.
do you think, what are you proposing for the future? Where are we individually and planetarily? Where are we going, and how can we get there?
Yeah, right, in the last 3 minutes. Sure, well, I'll tell you. I believe in actions on all levels. I believe in people working with their own habits of mind, the tendencies of mind to simply do what it always does. And come up with new, novel, creative ways of doing the same things or doing new things altogether just for the sake of some building a new neural net. I'm totally in favor of that. That being, in a sense, a template for being new in the world. I think we need to act both internally in cleaning our own lives up in many ways to become more, go from egocentric to world-centric to cosmocentric, as Ken Wilber, I feel, reminds us a lot. I think that's a really important thing. A lot of people, especially in the New Age movement, know almost nothing about what's going on with social issues around the world. I think it's incredibly important because if we're going to balance this out, it's going to be because we're understanding each other. You know, I think it may have been Martin Luther King who said, if you want peace, make sure you've got justice. You know, peace just doesn't come floating in on a cloud because we want it. It comes because people are feeling that they're being dealt with fairly. And I think it's really important for baby boomers, for adults, for young people to really grok the importance of this notion of the sacredness of justice in our world and integrity. And so that means the way I interact with everybody and the way I think about the world and the way I think about the cosmos is affecting it, as you and I have both been saying. But I also believe in direct action. I believe in building community. I believe in the local economy movement that is growing like mad around the world. I think all of these are contributing to our ability to enjoy each other, to step out of our own egoic nature into a world-centric nature, and then beyond that, And all of this contributes to a new kind of species growth, going back to a non-egoically based, not getting rid of the ego, by the way, just reproportioning it so that we can love each other openly and freely in ways and show compassion and have a lot of fun together while getting rid of the grips of the reptilian brain. I think the re-entry into our prefrontal cortex and hearts are going to bring us far along the evolutionary path, Alan, and having kind of good local organic food to eat along the way, taking care of our water, disengaging from the GMO world and you know, corporate business as usual, is all going to be helping us be healthy and nature connected and connected to each other.
Good. So, thank you. But tell me, what are you doing? Your work,
what am I doing? Well, yeah. I work on a few different levels. On one hand, I do see clients, individuals. I do couples counseling and even family counseling. I also see people using biofeedback and do stress management with a very sophisticated kind of energy reading software program. And I do higher brain living sessions and teach groups, therapeutic theater. I didn't really get a chance to talk about much, but that has a lot to do with...
Well, talk about that. We have a little time.
Yeah.
About therapeutic theater.
Yeah, therapeutic and inner theater are so much fun. And talk
what
about
is it?
Synchronicity. Basically, I do this work at Shivananda and now in New York, too, where we take either a past experience of somebody that somebody wants to rewire or a potential future experience that people want to do some rehearsal of, or a current relationship that is maybe giving them some trouble, or a certain kind of experience somebody wants to have. We help them have it by doing role-playing, where I, as the director, play director, alter ego, and we create a little bit of a scene. And I work primarily with one person, and then other people will play different roles in that person's life. And talk about synchronicity. There is this awesome, almost plasmic, I don't know how to describe, intelligence that hovers over and around these experiences. Because when somebody picks someone to be their husband, for instance, or their lover, or their boss, there is something in that person that shows up, that gets embodied. And we can do a role play where people can start to understand each other. They go from adversary to united field. It's awesome. And then they hug and they kiss, and before you know it, tears are flowing. Everybody connects on the heart level, and changes occur in the quantum field. I'll give you a quick example. In my group recently, there was a woman who was having some trouble with one of her sons when she was getting divorced. Her divorce that was lingering for a few years finally settled. The son got rather upset and agitated by the finality of it and started to sort of act out a little bit toward the mother. The mother came to the group and shared her experience. So we played it out where I played her and she played her son. And then there were other audience members who were bringing their rapt attention to the situation. And we played it out. Then we switched roles once or twice. And then we went back again. And by the end of it, there was some much greater sense of harmony between the two people. Now the son is off in his own world, you know, in his apartment, doing his thing. You know, he has no idea consciously that this is happening. But I said to her, this is occurring in reality in the quantum field. And I'm telling you that when you see him next, you will notice a notable change in the way you two are relating to each other. There will be a dynamic shift in that way you are talking to each other and feeling each other out. Well, right. She had to take my word for that. But I've done it so many times over so many years, I know that this is what happens. So the following group, she came back to me and said, Mitchell, I don't know how to say it, but I almost want to cry from happiness because my son came back and said, Ma, I think I was being a little too hard on you the other week when we were last talking, when I came to visit you. I realized it really isn't your fault. It's not really Daddy's fault that this is the way things happen, and I'm really sorry for being so harsh and hard on you. Let's, you know, kind of kiss and make up.
Mm-hmm. And that's because somehow the field shifted his awareness and his reality. And it sounds like family constellations. Do you ever
that's
do family
right.
constellations?
Oh, very
do
much.
You do that work? Have you done
oh,
it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. For me, that's yeah. part of the therapeutic theater, frankly. And
right.
I've interviewed
no,
Bert, and I've worked with him a little bit, and I love it. Yeah.
Did you get a chance to interview Bert? You
said? Yes, I did.
Oh, yeah, he's
he was
quite
here.
A genius.
Where were you? You should have been around.
I don't know where I was.
It was some years
know.
Back. Yeah, Bert Hellinger.
But I think
man.
He's, you know, a genius in what he's created as far as duplicating the field of the family and seeing what's off and really healing old issues that then create a happier future for everyone in that family, whether
exactly.
they're present in the room or not.
It's
and he's
so beautiful.
One, it's very
his,
shamanic.
A lot of his work is nonverbal. Mine is more verbal than what he does.
Right.
I think but, there's tremendous merit in both.
But it just yeah. all goes to show you that we are part of a field. We're influenced by the field as
yeah.
well as influencing the field.
Exactly.
And,
that's
a
big one. Mind over matter, mind over field.
Well,
you know?
We the mind is the field, and it's all,
yeah.
well, I think it's great. I think, you know, me and you will keep exploring the unknown,
yeah.
trading notes, and creating better worlds and new realities that
yeah, exactly.
the planet obviously needs. So
exactly.
It's exciting. And how can people get in touch with you, and what are you,
sure.
what are your next immediate plans?
Absolutely, sure. People can go visit, you know, I've got two websites for different functions in a way. MitchellRabin.com,
M-I-T-C-H-E-L-L,
R-A-B-I-N. Right, R-A-B as I, R-A-B-I-N.com is my work that I do with, you know, doing the coaching and the consulting and the group work. And then abetterworld.tv. Abetterworld.tv is my media where I'm on, like you, Alan, every Monday night. I'm on at 7 on A Better World TV. On Tuesday afternoons, I'm on Progressive Radio Network, Gary Null's station with Progressive Film Hour with Mitchell Rabin, where I interview. I did a film today called Occupy the Farm, which is about taking over some land in UC Berkeley. Very interesting. And then Wednesday nights, I have A Better World, and tomorrow night I'll be interviewing Karuna on Kundalini Yoga, a good friend of our friend, Kurt Johnson. And
okay.
abetterworld.tv. I've got a newsletter weekly that's for free, so if you go to abetterworld.tv, you can sign up for it and see what we're doing every week. It's really a lot of fun, and I very much welcome all of your participation. It's very
Mitchell,
cool stuff.
It's great. Keep going. Keep
Thank
Keep
you,
being on
friend.
The frontier. We're chopping away at the unknown.
We are. Yes.
Me and you and our differing, you know, we're carving, you know, parallel paths there because we want to make a big clearing
That's
for the
right.
future to arrive in a harmonious,
exactly.
beautiful way. So we
exactly.
need as many people like us on the front line carving
yes.
carving our own paths so
That's
there
right.
could be these new realities unfolding.
Exactly.
And it's always good because we are comrades, like seeing what
That's
the
right.
latest, you know, hottest information that the
And reviving the collector. Old. Like your trip
well,
to Australia coming up, Alan.
I know. I was going to yes, my
yeah,
trip to...
Yeah, you know, you and I are both very involved in breaking and waking up the indigenous wisdom and giving it a place in today's world. You and I are both playing that role. I think it's
right.
so important.
I wasn't going to mention that, but now that it's brought up,
yeah.
if people want to contribute to my upcoming film called Human Destiny, where I'm going to visit the Australian Aborigines, they
yeah.
can go to my website, newrealities.com, and
yeah.
look at how to be part of the Indiegogo campaign, which actually there's been some very generous people out there donating. So
oh,
it's
great.
Really a great thing. And I think indigenous wisdom, yes, absolutely. And, you know, this thing that I'm doing with Robert Lawler, you know who he is?
Robert? Of course I do, sure.
Well, his whole thing is that we are in the twilight of the Kali Yuga, and we are coming to the end of time as we know it, and we need to visit people from the beginning of time who never forgot their beginnings.
If
we're going to complete the cycle in a coherent manner and go to the next level of our evolution, unless we remember who we are as human beings, we're not going to go to the next level of awakening.
Yeah.
It's just, we need to remember this, and the Australian Aborigines are...
Oh, embody that.
They embody it and never lost it. They never lost that their connection.
Exactly.
So I'm excited. And
what you're doing. And if there's any role for me in anything you're doing with that film, you'll let me know if I can help.
Yeah,
you know.
I think it's great. I just got a message from my guy at the station. I don't know, maybe someone has a question, but I can't seem to get to the, anyway, I don't know where that is. Oh, wait, here. Let me just see if someone had a question for us. Stepping out for 5 minutes, be right back. So don't end your show until I yell you back about 3 or 5 minutes. Anyway, no. So I just want to say, though, thanks, Mitchell. So your main website is A Better World.
abetterworld.tv and mitchellrabin.com, which I don't know if you've visited that one yet, Alan, but...
I know, but I do want to ask you one more question,
sure.
And then we can go, but Michael Cotton is this guy who's invented this higher brain living. He's developed a new technology. Where is he at? Like, what is beyond the higher brain? What is the evolution for Michael Cotton and the higher brain living? Where is that going? And what does the future look like for that? Is a big question I have for you.
It's anybody's guess. I know what he is putting a huge amount of energy into, which is the building of a movement to catalyze interest in this kind of inner development and to utilize a technique that looks like it really accelerates this kind of development of consciousness. So he is squarely behind that, and he has a great group of people who are right alongside with him. And I'm one of those. I'm one of those people who is helping to advance that work on the planet, very much so. It's mysterious to me in that, you know, when you do these points and you get that result, it's like, wait a minute, how did that happen? You know,
you were actually surprised.
I had lead and now I have gold, you know?
Wait, you did not. So you learned these points, but you didn't expect people to actually start doing these kundalini movements because of these very subtle touches, even though you saw it happen in others, but actually being the facilitator of that is quite amazing, isn't it?
It is. It is.
It was surprising for you, you're saying. It's
very surprising because I also had network chiropractic for about a dozen years. And
yes.
I don't know if you remember when Donnie Epstein came here to our studio here.
I do. He actually worked on me. I did
remember?
Not feel the shift as I did in other network chiropractors, but... You know, I thought other network, for me, were a little more sensitive. So then what's the relationship then, Donnie?
Well, just to say, I had network chiropractic for some 10 or 12 years, and I did not get the wave. That's not what happens to me, and nor does that happen with higher brain living. However, I have had shifts of consciousness. I didn't really speak about this at all, but when I was out in Chicago getting the training and we did some intensive, you know, retreat days, we called them, I had some shifts of consciousness that reminded me of deep, long-term meditations that I have done in a Buddhist context and reminded me of experiences that you and I had together using the shamanically sanctioned plant from the Amazon, ayahuasca.
Uh-huh,
and
My ayahuasca thing was great at the time, but I see it is really creates a false ceiling. I think it has limited use.
What's a false feeling? That's a really interesting idea. Are you experiencing it or are you not? A false feeling.
No, a false ceiling. What I mean by that is that you think you're looking at the stars, but you're really looking at stars painted on a ceiling. That's my definition of...
sort of like the Truman Show.
The feelings are real. The feelings weren't false. I just think it's an illusionary new place, and I don't think it's an evolutionary tool, in a sense. I think it keeps people, especially people who do it habitually,
it's
kept them trapped and stuck within a thought form reality that doesn't let them experience, as you said, novelty. And I think novelty...
We sort of went into a whole other thing here, but I agree with that part completely, that people who do this habitually are missing the forest for the trees. It's kind of...
Yes, I
agree. Disturbing and upsetting. But you and I actually did it together initially back quite a long time ago. And it was explosive in its novelty. And
I had a good time, but...
I wasn't talking about that.
No, I don't know how explosive it was. I mean, I don't know what you mean.
Having experiences. I'll talk for myself. Inner experiences and revelations that were of dimensions that I had not seen before in a long time. I had never seen from that point of view completely. And it was in some ways very disturbing, disturbing, and also very illuminating and very confusing at other moments. I was seeing my own personal life from an entirely different point of view that was being revealed, almost like my subconscious, and this is the way I kind of describe it, the subconscious gets lit up, and you see things that are just below the surface, and the plant helps to elicit that kind of sight, so it's very novel.
My experience was a little different. I felt very blissful and joyful. I felt very in touch with my inner realities. I saw myself life from a deeper experience, but I always felt that same experience has always been with me. So I don't know if it was exactly the same thing, and it doesn't sound like as you have.
It's supposed to be. It's bio-individual, psycho-bio-individual, the way it should be. But you see, I personally believe, and you don't ask anybody else to believe this, and I think also many other, studiers and journeyers of entheogens see it as opening up certain kind of energetic pathways and portals that are interdimensional in nature and give us peaks. We don't move in. And, just like Carl Jung said, to commit suicide is sort of, sneaking a peek behind the curtain. So, too, similarly, but without the death.
But all you have, you don't need to do these medicine plants. All you have to do is remember your dreams. I mean, your dream states... And your dream worlds are as high.
I don't think it's an either or.
And they're right there, available for everyone every night. If you become lucid, and you know the work. Did you ever interview Sergio Magaña? You should definitely interview him.
He's the best. You and I both interviewed Robert Young. Wasn't his name
Robert Young? Yes. What about him?
Well, he did a lot about dream work. That was our shows.
Robert Young
in my living room here.
About Dream World. Anyway, I've interviewed lots of people, but I'm just saying that people really get stuck and the South American, like, exotic, medicine plant, and they're missing their own chemistry. They're missing their own connection. The multidimensional world... is right here, right now, as soon as we get over our conditioning.
Yes, I agree with that. I think that that's very much the case. And, you know, dreams are a portal in themselves without... I completely agree with you. I don't see it as an either-or, but a both-and. And I'm very, very reticent to ever recommend this to anybody anyway. I think it's really the exception of a person to utilize these sacred plants. But I think for some people, some of the time, at certain developmental points of their lives, it can be incredibly useful if done very judiciously. And I'm very, very, you know, kind of conservative, actually, about that kind of thing. But I feel for myself it's been a very great, potent teacher, as have my dreams been. So for me...
What did you learn from those plants that was the most exciting for you?
Well, I'll tell you one thing, Alan, that was the most profound.
Okay.
Which was that I felt utterly ensconced in the presence of the divine, inside and outside myself simultaneously.
Okay, that's legitimate. Thank
you. Any time, even though I was born Jewish, I was raised agnostic. I was not raised with any sense of godliness. It was a word that was essentially verboten in my home. Okay, I came to my own peace with the use of that word and the meaning behind it through my own inner explorations and reflections. And so when I say that I was 100, if not more, convinced isn't even the word, standing in the presence of the divine, and with such complete congruity and certainty, it was life-changing.
Could it be that we're always standing in the presence of the divine, but these things help us recognize that?
Yes, absolutely. And that's why I see it as useful, because it ripped asunder my barrier.
Okay, so are you standing in the divine now?
For whatever reason, it
dissolved the veil. Why does the veil come back?
Well, that's a whole other question. Now, I've had that veil removed, or I've removed it, however you want to think about it, many other times having nothing to do with sacred plants. Mm-hmm. It's happened through meditation. Sometimes it's happened by looking at a child. Sometimes it happened, relatively recently, it happened to me in a subway by looking at a woman talking to her friend who is blind, and they met on the subway platform. And an opening happened inside me that was awesome, and my heart just leapt out of my chest. It was like a train that I wasn't going to be on. I should have walked or something. But I said, no, just stay. Just stay. I don't know why. And because I stayed, I saw that interaction, and I had that experience.
Beautiful. Thank you. I mean, I think the work you're doing and the higher brain living is making us, and that's where I'm going as opposed to the sacred plants, the internal chemistry are making us more feeling people.
Yeah.
We don't need hallucinations or
no.
fantastic realities to
right.
to witness in these underworlds of you know, narcotics. We need to be more feeling, and that little thing that happened to you on the subway is a demonstration of the greater work. And that's the true saving of humanity, is the ability to feel. It's not to have the great visions of these other realities, because those other realities take away from the beauty of the reality here. I mean, I just reviewed this movie, Boyhood. Did you see that movie?
No.
It was the best movie of the year. It's
really?
Not a documentary, but Richard Linklater follows around these actors for 12 years and plays out these...
I heard, yes, of course.
It's read my review on my New Realities website, and you see, it really comes down to this ability to feel, and that represents our true evolutionary capacities.
Ah,
that's
you
what
are
the higher
on
thing.
It. Absolutely.
Well, that's what I feel the higher brain living is all about, opening up new
awarenesses. That's what I keep saying about the spilling over in the prefrontal cortex to the heart cortex, that and the heart coherence. Absolutely. That's really where I feel the game is. And you said that very beautifully, and I'm very, no pun intended, heartened to hear you say that, because that really is where life lives, is in the feeling domain.
Well, I call that the flowering of humanity. As the prefrontal cortex flowers into the thousand-petal lotus,
it opens the space in the heart.
Right, and the compassion of the Buddha field starts to come in, and we see everyone as ourselves. So, of course, those people on the subways were you, because you started to feel a feeling free. So I think ayahuasca and those things take away, for the most part, they can have great effect, but by doing them over and over again, and I'm not saying you did, but they take away from that immediate, innate human capacity to sense.
Exactly.
Because we're out of our senses on those things, and we have to get back into our senses and start to feel each other, you know?
Yeah. You know, everybody needs a different thing at a different point in their evolution. That's the way I look at it. I don't think these things were put on Earth by mistake. I think everything is part of an integral whole. I respect the shamanic journey going back thousands of years, including the Aboriginals, who had their own form. I'm not familiar with it.
I thought they did hallucinogenics, though, the Aboriginals.
And it's because it's part of our natural inheritance. And I'm very wary of judging it negatively at all. I just see right place, right time, right person at the right moment. That's really what it is.
At the right moment in their life, and that's okay. But the bigger thing, and I'm not against it again, the bigger thing is the connection and the awareness in the ordinary states of consciousness.
Yeah.
It's not the extraordinary or the extraordinary.
Absolutely.
It's the common realities.
Exactly. And, you know, so it's the magic in the moment, so to speak, and that has to do with a shift in consciousness that we're all capable of all the time. That's what a lot of the teachings always have said. That's what neuroscience is also, you know, some of it is suggesting, that we have that ability to shift our consciousness and step into kind of a nonverbal. Oh, let me say this. Many, many moons ago, I did what was called a datun, which was a 30-day meditation on a Tibetan Buddhist Christian called a Gamden up at what's known as Karma Choling in Barnett for Namant, part of the Kagyu lineage of under the auspices of Trungpa Rinpoche.
Mm-hmm.
And meditating quietly 12 to 14 hours a day, sitting and walking, sitting and walking, changed my life, Alan. This was in the early 80s, and I came back to New York. I was just telling this story the other day. I was like a marshmallow. I was so inwardly at peace. The only chemical was oxygen and water. And I was so not in my head, so in my body, so soft and flowing. There we go again. With everything and everyone around me, no resistance. It was an awesome experience. And I got to see how urban living can harden us, and it hardens us and mentalizes us in ways that we're not even aware of. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I swung over to that softer, new consciousness that I saw how hard I had become, and people are, in this kind of gritty, fabulous, but gritty context.
It can be that way, or you can, and I'm not saying it's easy, or you can see it as a collection of humanity that's just trying to feel each other's way through existence, because all we have is our humanity in this city. We hardly have nature, but we do have human nature.
Yeah.
And if we could come to, you know, collectively a new awareness of that, then we can create the paradise on earth that we all, you know.
Yeah.
But, and I think, you know, we of course need nature, absolutely, to remind us of who we really are. And, but no, thank you for that, because
sure.
We need to go within. We need to have those experiences of ourselves, because that,
yeah.
I mean, the best thing, you know, the key thing I would say that you said here is that by creating a new awareness in the frontal lobes, we awaken a greater humanity in us, and it's reflected outside of us. And that's where I think we're going.
God bless.
So thank you, Mitchell, for everything.
Alex, my pleasure.
Thanks for, you know, years of friendship.
Yes,
probably
indeed.
What now, 35, 40?
Yeah.
Somewhere in the 80s,
Alan.
I think we ran into each other, and here we are still at it.
Exactly.
Parallel.
We really are. We're very good friends, and we're running parallel and overlap and help and support each other all the time. It's just, it's in the field, man. It's in the field.
Yeah. We're aspects of the field. We're building this
yeah.
field. So again, your website, A Better World TV.
abetterworld.tv and mitchellrabin.com. So please
Mitchell,
come and
R-A-B-I-N.
Join all of that.
Thanks. Okay, I'll let you
Absolutely,
know when this
Alan.
Is
Alan. Thank you so much. You're a gracious host, and I so appreciate being on with you tonight and sharing with your audience.
I've wanted to do this for a while. I know we've talked about this, and I'm interested because I feel, you know, we see each other on the street, we talk or some social thing. You don't get to go deep into what your, you know, passion, inner interests are. And an interview is sort of like more like a deepening of friendship that
That's
allows
right.
me to understand your inner realities. Just
exactly.
like your interview with me, I was able to maybe express things that
By
you may
all
not.
By all means, I was just about to say that. And mm-hmm. you now have a permanent place on our website at abetterworld.tv. Anybody could put in your name, Alan Steinfeld, into the search engine and come up with our dynamic interview on A Better World. You know?
Okay.
And I agree with you wholeheartedly. We're very, you know, we're with each other in so many ways and doing all these administrative, practical kinds of things in our various organizations, you know. But when do we get a chance to really plumb down into the deeper spaces, you know? And
well,
that's
what I recommend for people who are friends or even
exactly.
family members. Let's say you were to interview your father or my
that's
mother.
Right.
Spend time with a friend for an hour and just ask them questions about their deeper concerns
exactly.
and it'll increase your friendship, and you'll learn more about the person than you may
ever
not have
thought.
Known for ever thought for 30 or 40
yeah.
years. So,
yeah.
I mean, I think interviews are sometimes a lot more intimate than just friendly relationships.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
So,
I know. I totally get it. And I think that's a really good idea. I mean, you've now got my mind thinking about interviewing my own father. I don't know if
I'm
you would
gonna
go
call
for
it interview therapy that people should do with each other.
You know, really, it's just beautiful. It really is. And I'd like to actually share one
yes.
other little thing. Is
Please,
you just
go
spoke
ahead.
About you just made reference to human nature in the city but I want to say that I actually believe that we are nature deficient. In the city and even outside
yes.
the city, we're yeah. so technologized, we're so much engaged in all of our electronics and all of this stuff, and all of the stuff of our daily lives, consumerism, and all the stuff that we really lost touch with the magnificence and miraculousness of mm-hmm. nature when nature outside ourselves. It's not, right. It looks outside, but it's really
You know
inside.
What the substitute for that is in the city, the substitute for nature?
Is.
It's food, sex, yep. and animals, and pets.
That's right.
How people, and that doesn't really do it. Those are
no.
like, they're great substitutes, but they're not the substitutes.
They're not
that
the thing itself, exactly. We want to keep food, sex, and animals, but we want to also expand. You know, I'll be going down to Gary Null's Paradise Gardens on Saturday.
But
for
that's
2 weeks.
Why those things are out of balance, because we're missing the nature that feeds our total being. No, I totally agree with you, on that.
It's so nourishing. It's so detoxifying. It's so cleansing. It's so purging. It's so emotionally balancing when we are in nature, when we're under the sun, when we see beauty. You know, James Joyce talked about aesthetic arrest. You know what it's like to behold a garden of flowers. There's something that happens magically inside us, Alan, that it has no parallel, you know?
Right. Anyway, Mitchell, I do have to go. Thanks.
Me too. It's been great talking with you, Alan. Thanks so much for the chance.
Okay.
And we'll carry on.
All right. Okay. Thanks. Okay. I was talking to Mitchell Raven for A Better World. I'm Alan Steinfeld for my website. You can find me as New Realities. You can reach me at newrealities@earthlink.net. Thanks for listening. Next couple of weeks, I'm going to have some very amazing guests coming up. I'm going to try to get the woman who was at the center of the Andreasen affair, UFO abduction that happened over 20 years. And she has an incredible story that was also told in a book called The Watchers. And thanks for listening tonight. So listen to me next week. Okay, good night.